will be witness to what I have discovered. May you be the jury, but your verdict will be one of self-conviction. I know what I have witnessed. Now it is your turn. Prepare yourself for a journey into a world where each new step may give you a better understanding of your own reality.
Hello. Welcome to the Evolver Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Shaw. And I want to say first, thanks to Chris Hopkins from Evolver Sacramento for first starting this podcast in 2010. He did some awesome interviews, and you can find those previous episodes on realitysandwich.com and on our disinfo page. So I'm tentatively calling this the Sporecast in reference to the Evolver Spore community, which is an online and offline network that spreads transformative ideas and helps people find the others. And that's the idea with this podcast, is spreading transformative ideas in hopes of connecting like-minded people. So this first Sporecast features two interviews. First, we'll hear Charles Eisenstein interviewed by Chris Hopkins, who started this podcast. And Charles talks about his book, Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition. And next we'll hear from poet, performer, and activist Ann Waldman, interviewed by Robin Gunkel from Evolver Baltimore. So let's get started. Here's Charles Eisenstein on his book, Sacred Economics.
Hello, I'm here today with Charles Eisenstein, who just had his new book released on July 12th, Sacred Economics, which Evolver is publishing. How are you doing today, Charles?
Doing great. Thanks for bringing me on, Chris.
Yeah, I'd love to have you. So I guess I'll just start off with, could we get a little introduction into just kind of a general idea, a starting point, so to give people an idea for us this interview of what exactly you're talking about with sacred economics?
Yeah, a lot of people notice the apparent incongruity in the title, Sacred and Economics, because in our experience of life, if anything is not sacred, it's money, simply because it seems to be the enemy of all of the great things that we want to do in the world. Anytime that we want to be generous or devote ourselves to some cause, there's this voice that says, well, can you really afford to do that? You know, will you be okay financially if you replant forests and teach people how to garden and do all these things, and you don't even really want to take money for them? And then also on a social, political, or global level too, you look into any bad thing that's happening in the world, and you ask, why is this happening? And you ask a couple why questions, a couple levels down, you get to money. Why are there so many prisons? Why is cannabis illegal? Why are we fighting one war after another? Why is, what's going on with the pharmaceutical industry and healthcare? You know, you ask a couple whys and you get down to profits and to money. So money certainly seems to be not sacred. But so the question I kind of launched the book with is, why should it be that way? Because money is a social creation. It's an agreement that a certain symbol has value. And if it's simply an agreement, then why have we agreed to create a system of value that encourages things that are destructive of society and the planet? And how could we forge a new kind of agreement? And what would the transition process be? And what would that agreement look like? That's essentially what I'm writing about. And that's kind of an abstract description of it. I mean, I do go into a lot of really specific details.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of overarching idea.
All right. I know one thing that comes up a lot for me when I'm discussing new ideas with people and just ways that they can change the world or their lives. for instance, like the sacred economics idea, a lot of times they, well, what can I do to change the world? What impact would that actually have on my life? And I guess the question I have is, what do you think this philosophy of sacred economics, what kind of an impact do you think it could actually have on the individual's life if they just adopted this philosophy for themselves?
Yeah. I would hesitate to call it a philosophy.
Yeah.
Although I guess it includes a philosophy. It's a social revolution in a way, or social evolution. And it's also a way of thinking and a way of being and a way of relating to the world. So it has certainly a personal component as well. And a portion of the book is on the shift of consciousness that corresponds to a new kind of economy. But I don't really agree with some of the more New Age, you know, prosperity programming kind of people who say that, you know, money's not the problem. The problem is only our attitudes. And we just have to change the way we think about money, and then we'll all be in abundance. That is impossible when we have a money system that has scarcity built into it,
yeah,
which ours does. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that a shift of consciousness is an indispensable part of a social economic shift, because ultimately our civilization is built on our consciousness, and civilization affects consciousness, and consciousness affects civilization. So it's kind of a gestalt here where all elements on all levels, from the personal, family, social, ecological level, they're all undergoing a parallel shift at the same time. I haven't really answered your question, but there's a whole part of the book about, I call it living in the gift.
Yeah.
And so it's an orientation of our economic activity toward the gift, toward what am I here to give? What is my purpose on earth? What do I want to create? Rather than how can I make a living? We kind of, today we put the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
We mortgage our choices to the necessity of making a living. And when we do that, we often end up making choices that we don't like, because the incentive structure, the reward system that's built into money, because of the way that it's created and circulated, ultimately encourages us to do the things, you know, it incentivizes us to do the things that we don't really want to do.
Yeah. So are there any products or things that exist today, like in our economy, in our world, that you don't think will have much of a place when we kind of reshift into a more gift giving oriented, like sacred economy?
Well, you know, let me just kind of, again, approach it from a really general perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of, environmentalists say, you know, we're using way too much of the Earth's natural resources. Our ecological footprint it would require many Earths to sustain for any period of time. We're going to have to make do with less. We're going to have to make some sacrifices. But I think that actually we're going to have to make do with more. Because most of the things that we produce don't really serve human happiness.
Mm-hmm.
For centuries now, our productive capacity has risen exponentially.
Yeah.
And we have, nonetheless, we work just as hard now as we ever have. In fact, leisure peaked in about 1973. But for some reason, and actually the reason is no mystery, and I describe it in the book, it again has to do with the money system. For some reason, with every invention of a labor-saving technology, we have not actually chosen to work less. It hasn't actually saved labor. Every single time we've chosen to consume more. instead. And this consumption, we're realizing today, doesn't necessarily make us any happier. Our lives, the lives of rich people, are full of superfluous crap.
Yeah.
You know, like gigantic mansions, like McMansions, several thousand square feet that have, you know, they are hardly inhabited. You know, like a middle-aged couple living in a 5,000 square foot house with this cavernous living room that they never go into because it's not even on a human scale. You know, they spend their time in the breakfast nook, you know, or the den, and like, does it really serve their needs? And the material wealth, as it's called, of even my neighborhood, which is a very, you know, middle-class neighborhood. Like, every single house has its own lawnmower. Every single house has its own set of power tools, probably.
Yeah.
There's so much duplication, and each of these lawnmowers is used about 10 hours a year, 15 hours a year. Like, we would be just as well off if we had two lawnmowers for the whole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. In fact, we'd be better off because we'd have more space, and we'd be able to interact with each other when we went to the lawnmower shed. But instead, we each have our own, and it doesn't make us any happier. And so many other products, like hydrogen bombs and electronic billboards and just like all this plastic junk, they don't make people happier either. They don't serve real human needs. So I think that, in fact, often these things are substitutes for what people really want and need, which is connection, play, intimacy, the experience of beauty, to explore. You know, these are fundamental human needs that aren't met in our atomized, alienated society. And so we kind of assuage the longing.
Yeah.
By filling it up with stuff. And so I think that, you know, a world without, say, you know, plastic bags is not a poor world at all. Mm-hmm. It's, and without, you know, so much mass produced stuff, where, for example, one thing that I think we'll see much less of, and we're already feeling the pull in that direction, is away from mass produced food.
Yeah.
And toward locally produced food that's, you know, connected to the land, connected to the local weather, connected to the local people. And that food, it meets a need that supermarket food just can't meet. And so we're already feeling a pull toward that kind of stuff. And I think that many categories of consumer goods will become more local. Like, supermarkets will have a very, very limited niche. And so that's, you know, that's one trend, I guess I could predict. Yeah.
I think there's places in the world that are actually already moving away from that stuff based on necessity. Like, I mean, China has all the hunger issues with 2 billion people to feed. And places like Shanghai, one of the biggest cities in the world, grows 87% of its own food inside its own city walls, you know. And there's a lot of places in life, or in Japan, their economy has been so ravaged that they don't have the money to provide for their people. So the government is actually running all these time banks to help meet the needs of their people. And
yeah,
I think it's only
I think that's a really significant development. One thing that we're seeing is the money system stops working. Is people are inventing other ways to facilitate the flow of goods or services, or you could say to facilitate the flow of gifts, because really that's what money is supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, money is supposed to be like, you know, I have something I want to give you, but you don't have anything you want to give me, so you give me money instead. And money. So money is supposed to, you know, facilitate flow. It's not doing that very well anymore. So people are inventing other ways to do that, or going back to ancient ways to do that. And Japan is a good example here. I don't know if everybody listening knows what a time bank is, but basically you offer your services and someone, you know, finds you on the electronic bulletin board or whatever, and so you perform that service. Maybe you cut their grass or something like that. And if it took 2 hours, then you get paid two time dollars. And then you can use those for somebody else's service. So it looks very similarly to money, but you're not using the national currency. And the interesting thing that happens when, from an economic point of view, or from, let's say, an economist's point of view, this is actually bad for the economy because GDP is going down. Because GDP only counts goods and services exchanged for money. So if you just do things for people as a gift, for example, you, even if on the level of cooking for your family, that's not counted as economic growth. But if you go to a restaurant and pay somebody to cook for your family, then GDP goes up. Mm-hmm. And an economist would say, your standard of living has gone up. The economy has grown. The well-being of this people, of this culture, has grown because they are spending money on things they didn't used to spend money on. So in Japan now, everyone's looking and saying, oh, Japan, you know, economic basket case, the two lost decades, you know, they've barely grown their economy at all. Well, then you actually go to Japan and things don't seem really that bad at all. You know, and the economy could shrink and we could become better off, actually, if there are other ways that we're meeting our needs. For example, today I just downloaded a open source image editing program, GIMP, it's called.
Yeah.
I didn't pay anything for that. I did not contribute to GDP. But if I had bought Photoshop, then that would have added, you know, whatever, a few hundred dollars or however much it costs to GDP. Mm-hmm. So this whole internet-based gift economy is also shrinking GDP. But contrary to an economist's view, it's not shrinking our well-being. But it's causing economic problems because the only way today that money circulates is through interest-bearing loans, which only happen if somebody has, I'm simplifying here, but if somebody has a business idea that's going to create even more goods and services.
Yeah.
Once, and that, if the economy is not growing, there are not a lot of good investment opportunities. So the owners of money keep it. Mm-hmm. They keep it as deposits in the Federal Reserve. They don't lend it out. And money stops circulating. There's no jobs. And the division between rich and poor widens. And it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. So,
and that's the kind of the economics part of the book. You know, I explain exactly why and how this happens, why it's collapsing mm-hmm. right now in these few years, and how money would have to be tweaked so that it could flow in the context of a steady state economy or even a degrowth economy.
Yeah. I think there's actually some significant steps being made in America right now too, to kind of recognize some of our economic systems that are broken. For example, I actually work, I'm a creative director for another company, and we're trying to develop a product right now to help with a technology to help with independent assisted living. So I've been mm-hmm. following that really closely. And there was a bill that was just passed in America where they're actually going to give a short stint in or a stint in certain areas of the country to where the Medicare reimbursement plan is more geared towards prevention and limiting doctor's appointments and medication and lowering the cost mm-hmm. of healthcare. And a lot of those places are going to do this through these kind of health technologies. And yeah. It's interesting because pharmaceutical companies are actually the biggest funders right now of these preventative health technologies because they realize that that's the economy we're moving towards. And the bill actually has it written in that if it's successful in these small places that they start with, then they can immediately expand it to the rest of the country without having to go back through Congress. And I think that's just a clear example of an economic system being broken in America, and we're actually changing it. I think that's happening all over the world.
I'm not familiar with that, with the example you talk about. It sounds a little bit incongruous that pharmaceutical companies would promote practices that would hurt their own profits. I know that they've been, you know, over the years, pretty aggressive in, combating the move toward herbal medicine and anything that can't be patented and sold.
Yeah. I think the difference in this case is that it's technology that they can patent. But it's also that because of this bill that just passed, where actually the money that's going to go to people, like where the money is going to be with the way that we're headed with it, is in this sustainable technology, you know, and that's why they're doing it, because of the money, you know. Uh-huh. I think it's very, very telling, actually, that the pharmaceutical companies are going there because they realize that we have to. That's where money will be. That kind of leads me into the question of what are some like real world models and things that you've seen happening that actually are telling points to you that we're moving towards this economy. Do you have examples?
Indicator that we're at the verge of a big transition is just the breakdown in the system that we have today. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that all around in the debt crisis, you know, and the riots in London, it's a kind of a phony crisis of the debt ceiling here, but in Europe, it's very real. The unemployment rate, which has almost no hope of going down now, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty much permanent high unemployment. These are all pointing the gyrations in the stock market, you know, the growing recognition that the level of debt is unsustainable, and you know, the incredible polarization of wealth, unprecedented between rich and poor. And worsening. And most people who study the financial system realize that it can't go on too much longer. You know, municipalities going bankrupt, you know, I mean, just on every level.
Yeah.
From the personal to the local government to the national government level, corporations, banks. I mean, you know, the system is really tottering. And as it falls apart, and I'm not really so much of a collapsist where I think that, you know, we're going to be living in, boxcars and shipping containers and without electricity. Although that might be fun. But I think that there's still the possibility of an evolutionary change that includes everybody. So again, not one of these scenarios where there's billions of casualties, or on the New Age side, you know, where some people ascend and others are left behind. I think we're still all in this together.
That was Charles Eisenstein on his book, Sacred Economics. And you can read it chapter by chapter on Reality Sandwich, and also find it in print through North Atlantic Books. And so next we have an interview with poet Anne Waldman in conversation with Robin Gunkel from Evolver Baltimore. I've actually only included about 30 minutes of this 45-minute interview, and I'll include the link to the full audio on the Reality Sandwich story. So before this clip starts, Anne is describing her relationship to Allen Ginsberg and the Beats, how it was to be a woman in the Beat movement, and her co-founding with Allen Ginsberg of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. So when this clip starts, she's saying, "We agreed on this cultural intervention," and she's referring to the Kerouac School. So here's Robin Gunkel interviewing Anne Waldman.
Beyond the culture. So we agreed on this cultural intervention at the Kerouac School.
Ah, thank you. Actually, that leads me into my next question, which was to ask you, you know, about being a woman, a Buddhist, and a writer in the intersection between these spaces. Do you have any other thoughts to share on that?
Well, I think I came to Buddhism at a fairly early age. I had a wonderful teacher in high school, comparative religion teacher. I was very interested in Taoism, Hinduism, animism, the Shinto, you know, cosmology of Japan, and then was able to meet quite early on a Mongolian Lama, very close to the Tibetan lineage and practices. And then by the time Trigon Trungpa, the founder of Naropa, was in the States, I'd already met him by 1970 in New York. And so there was a little bit of ground. I had read, certainly, you know, some early texts, and like many people of my generation, encountered Alan Watts when I was in high school, and then began a more formal Buddhist practice by the early 70s. And I think, you know, I had issues with the some of the forms of the practice. They seemed too rigid or maybe patriarchal in some way. So many of the teachers are men, and so on. But I remember Gary Snyder saying that Vajrayana Buddhism would be very appealing to women because of the vivid depictions of female energies and deities. You know, these red-skinned women with skulls around their necks, stomping on,
yes,
you know, riding leopard skins and stomping on the corpse of ego, skull bones around their neck. So it was a very vivid image for females, some of these depictions and visualizations for, you know, what female or feminine energy does. It's not necessarily female. You can be of a male body and a female disposition and so on. But the view that you know, feminine energy that creates environment, that creates empty space and then dances within that. So I always liked that vision of a, you know, non-static reality. And so that appealed to me as I became more committed to the Tibetan Buddhist practice and view, and the you know, for example, the Tara figure, which is white Tara, is a very pacifying figure, and then the green Tara is much more about action and accomplishment and doing things. So I was very, as a poet, very interested in the ideas and some of the, you know, sort of the poetry of the vividness of the, you know, actual images and depictions. And then, I think, you know, becoming a mother, a combination of things, feeling very nurturing about the, you know, the Naropa project and the Kerouac School, as I had about the poetry projects and some of these publishing ventures and so on. It all started to synchronize the notion of activity in the world, helping create community and infrastructure, keeping, you know, my own poetry practice, keeping the sort of Buddhist view, which is so close to something like negative capability, that you're, you know, you're able to live within contradictions. You're able to keep a kind of balance, no matter how horrific the phenomenal samsaric world gets. That you sort of keep your feet and you cut through to, you know, create alternatives to passion, ignorance, and aggression that are often out of control. So I found that Buddhism helpful in terms of being a skillful means toward, you know, political action and cultural action, and also, you know, to pacify my own demons and try to get synchronized into the you know, body, speech, and mind, into the moment of whether it's composition or listening to someone else or collaboration. So I think some, you know, as I was getting more involved with, you know, just time, these things become sort of integrated and necessary. I never felt the you know, compartmentalization of these different kinds of practices. They seem to all be able to come together.
Thank you. Well, that leads into another question that I was going to ask. Last month, 40-plus Evolver cities hosted a spore called Revolution 2.0. The focus of the spore was the next phase of revolution in our world. I was hoping that you could tell us about your experiences in the 60s and 70s and how you've seen the face of revolution shift. What are your hopes for today's activists, and what advice might you give us?
Oh, my, a big question.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, the skillful means was this cultural work and work in poetry and my own, you know, my own long poem, which is an investigation on war and patriarchy, and I see it as a feminist practice. The sense of, you know, back then there were very specific issues. The Vietnam War, of course, magnetized people towards working together in a community action. We, you know, fighting for basic human rights, fighting for, you know, killing these censorship laws. And so a lot of things were, you know, within my early years as a writer, there were, you know, there was the Howell trial, trying to think of myself as a writer, the Naked Lunch trial, and so on. And, you know, there was a sense when one became aware also of artists in other parts of the world, the, you know, people being jailed for their writing, for their beliefs, etc. So, you know, there seemed to be ways to keep yourself informed, be attentive. I mean, we were doing benefits at St. Mark's Church in Bowery in the Lower East Side and often working collaboratively with other organizations. I saw change going on in terms of gender issues, with people involved with Stonewall, of course, saw some change. And of course, I was in New York City where, you know, it's the forefront of certain kinds of shifts, paradigm shifts. But still felt that, you know, more women were coming into their own. There were, and certainly in the last decade, so many great younger women writers and magazines and venues and communications and studies, scholarly work. So I've seen a lot of change around gender, around race, and around political action, although, you know, the struggles in these times are daunting and endless. So I have to keep this perspective in mind. There's a wonderful Buddhist slogan. Dharma gates, meaning the gates of reality, are endless. I vow to enter every one of them. So that's kind of a view. I think, you know, I think community is very important in these kinds of activities. This is true in the 60s, 70s. We founded the project in 64, 65, really. And it still continues. Europa began in 74. It continues. And so you have to, you know, pick your project as well as your battles. We're still battling the situation with Rocky Flats, although it's closed down, and it's been raised. There's still toxicity in the soil, and we're fighting the opening of a wildlife refuge center there because it's been not safe. So there's been a series of events I participated just a week ago, bringing attention to the local situation. And, you know, this is one of the most toxic places on the planet. In the 70s, we were protesting quite continuously, and at one point I was arrested with Daniel Ellsberg and Allen Ginsberg, and you know, at Naropa we used to say, come study with people who've been arrested for their beliefs. It's a little slight shift now, but I would say look at your strengths and community, pick your battles, stay with it, you know, don't be a dilettante about your, you know, your political and cultural work, activist work, you know, take. When I worked on the Manatee Project, I wanted to investigate, you know, focus on the life of the Manatee, try to get into that, some kind of empathetic state of mind. So, you know, as well with your poetic project that you invoke investigation, and really know your where you're putting your attention. But I, you know, I saw incredible change. I also saw incredible. Losing heart. I think a lot about how to stay regenerative with the, you know, situations at hand. We need to really focus, of course, as we have 50 years on psychological issues, and, you know, there are many ways to involved. I think when you're writing practice, but with many, many different types of groups, considering, alternative energy, we've seen so much devastation with floods and fire, and that sort of thing, to stay, very, very focused there. Don't be naive, and also know the science. Be articulate on behalf of other life forms.
Wow. Do you see a connection between the death of the natural world and, the death of peoples whose cultures have been destroyed, their language being destroyed?
Oh, of course. No, it's terrible language-side. So much is disappearing, and certainly that. Very important for, I suggest that writers find endangered language, investigate a culture, travel, communicate with other kinds of writers and poets. Don't be so solipsistic and, lost in your, American world. No, I'm very, we're taking up hybridity and diasporas and how, people can build on a bigger view.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I was interested in the death of the natural world and the death of natural language. And are they the same thing?
I think we have to work with language, not just another language, but revisioning language. And you have to keep it on, it's like music and like other artistic forms. We're actually making, creating something, making something with language, and finding a language that's not the language of empire, finding a language that's not just command and martial and so on, and or just communicating very idiotic things. And exploring other forms, other genres even of expression. I mean, I've been very interested in working oral, different kinds of oral genres for years. So that some studies take me to India and Indonesia and very indigenous practices.
Thank you. So your poem, Fast Speaking Woman, is modeled after the chants of Mazatec shaman Maria Sabina. Sabina said, "Language makes dying return to life. I cure with language." What are your poem? You embody every identity of woman. It's like an Indra's net of woman. I see this as a healing in itself. Do you see your poem as a healing? What are your thoughts on Sabina?
Well, I think she's one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. Here's a woman without any formal education, barefoot most of her life, survived difficult family relations, marriages, so on, kept her practice very pure. I think it was, she was challenged towards the end of her life with many people coming to seek her out and seek out the magic mushrooms. And, she talked about how the energy was leaving the place and the practice she was doing because of this influx. But, these things come back around, of course. And her poem is, one of the great oral pieces of all time, I think. I mean, it's so expansive. And so generous, and it's a Veleda, it's a night watch guiding people through these different realms. And again, the realm of, I would say, female energy, which is the word in Sanskrit is prajna, so the sense of environment and space, and then empowering, through the anaphoric repetition of, I'm a this woman, I'm a that woman, and it's meant continue and move around. You can add on expand it that way. So in a very, very open form. I think that poem is an open system, and I feel she gave a kind of permission to explore it as well. But, there's a wonderful book about her, and there's a oral autobiography of her life, which I think is know, very, very important part of the canon of, you know, a larger view of poetics and ethnopoetics and so on. That was the term used, I think, out of fashion now, but, you know, real attention to these art practices and mind practice and psychological practice, language practice, and communal practice as well. So this, you know, that particular text of hers, which again is like a night watch, is you know, a particular form. It's a social form. It's meant to take place in public space. So that really is very, very strong. Her, that sense of her role as a curandero.
Did you ever meet her in person?
No, I tried.
No.
I wasn't able to get to Oaxaca until later.
Mm-hmm.
I was in touch with people who lived there with her and knew her. I had a photo of her, and, you know, mm-hmm. sadly, no.
Wow. Would you talk about that outrider poetics at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied
sure.
Poetics? Yeah, like
the term we started using. This term outrider comes from a sort of a Western term, the person who rode outside the herd, or, you know, had another role than just being a cattle driver or sheep herder. But that sense of, rather than outside, you know, completely outsider practice and work, that it's, you're riding alongside the, so, you know, interacting with the flow of your particular time and culture, and you're contemporary with it. I think that's also an idea. So, we wanted to invoke, you know, a sense of our own kind of lineage, sense of lineage and path, which is through the, what we call the New American Poetics, but so much beyond that, and has been extended in so many ways by generations since. But that, you know, rather than being part of the more official verse culture or a certain kind of prosody, which perhaps foregrounds, you know, the schematics and certain formal strictures, that there's an open form, that the poet is more of a field poet and kind of out in the air, out in the atmosphere, but, you know, and again, an investigator of one's own mind and consciousness, but also what, you know, what can be around one as well. So Maria Sabina's work really exemplifies an open mind, and also the sense of speaking language, speaking it, projecting it out, making it enter public space and be heard and experienced. The, you know, the mellow poeia of her poetry.
You've actually released a lot of CDs of poetry. Your most recent work is The Milk of Universal Kindness, that you and your son Ambrose Bai created. Would you speak to us about, and your inspiration for creating it? What is The Milk of Universal Kindness?
Well, that actually comes from a line from a poem by the poet Reed Bai, Ambrose's mm-hmm. father, and it's a poem called Avalokiteshvara.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the sky descends this kind of nipple and coming down from the sky and feeding us. So that's the milk of universal kindness, the spaciousness, again, of a sort of female principle. But we've worked together often on these collaborative pieces and performing together and creating these CDs. And I think Ambrose grew up, of course, at the Jack Kerouac School and counted Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs and others as kind of, you know, extended family, godfathers. He heard a lot of poetry, and, you know, rather than becoming a poet himself, although he's a good word worker, he creates these wonderful scapes and soundscapes for the poetry. And so we began working together. Often he would, you know, suggest a selection of something of mine or extract something from a longer piece. So the bits of the long poem on our new CD, there are 11 pieces, sort of a range of texts that include some of the manatee humanity. There's a piece where I'm sort of castigating when future generations come along, they'll look back and condemn us. So there's this sort of environmental nexus to that poem. So there's a couple of pieces there. There's the piece, The Radial Symmetry of the Younger Sister, where I'm kind of based on some dream images. And then the last two pieces on the CD come out of this collage and montage work that's in the Ovis project. But I love the layers that Ambrose puts together, and that, you know, there's subtleties in sound that reflect sometimes the language or night, but they have their own vitality and originality. So it's not, they aren't just underscoring, and they're not just highlighting or thematically sort of overdoing a particular idea, but, you know, he's got his own sort of flow going. So, you know, it's fabulous to work with your family.
Wow. Yeah, I love listening to it. It just really inspired me to create my own poetry CD. And I did really feel that the poetry wasn't just, it had its own life beside the poems, and that they equally coexist together.
Oh, great. Thank you. No, we were just in Europe performing in Italy in a festival in Brussels, and Amber is going to help teaching my class where we actually record the students and talk about different ways to work with text and with other voices and with things you can do in the studio and their own instrumentation and collaboration. So, yeah, we're a good team.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Thank you.
We read in a squad in Milan, and then we were in a beautiful palazzo in Vicenza, and the frescoes on the walls. So I feel like we, again, can enter a lot of different spaces with this work. You know, it's hard to define what it is. I wouldn't call it exactly spoken word. I wouldn't call it, it's just for me a new kind of collaboration.
Okay. So I guess my last question, in your collection of essays, Vow the Poetry, you've written a Kali Yuga manifesto about Kali Yuga poetics. What are Kali Yuga poetics, and how do these poetics inform us in the Kali Yuga age? Where is the culture? Do we go from here?
Oh, big question.
Yes.
Wonderful, vast questions. Well, Kali Yuga is the age we're in. It's only the beginning of the dark age. Things become very heightened in their intensity, probably more suffering, more ecological degradation, more confusion in people's minds, more addiction, more complicated realities just in this whole interconnected world, and shifts in power and I think what we have to really keep focused on is the horrific development of obscene and cruel weaponry. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about weather weaponry. I referenced this a little in the long epic poem where you can actually create, it's not as if we don't have enough to deal with our floods and fires and famine, but create these situations. So the fact that the human mind, although it's, also developing along maybe in other ways towards, a radical consciousness, as, we see it as experience and so on, there's also this agenda from the war in God realm to keep creating and perpetuating these wars, so you can, juice it up even more. And, of course, many, many people get rich off these conflicts and struggles and genocide. So the power struggles are intense, not to mention, there'll be shortages of water and food. I think, there'll be wars over water, not just oil.
Yes, yes.
So, there's these dark, just being realistic about the statistically, the numbers of people, the projections into the future, all the billions of people on the planet, the food supply, the water, the danger of things out of control, the build now, the you know, the continuing nuclear power situation, is this position is enough to break us up? And so, and, you know, those things can be very heartbreaking, I guess. And so you have to live with your broken heart, with your wounded heart, but not become realistic, not become, you know, completely suicidal, although a lot of these thrusts seem that way. And also, there are many people like yourself, you know, find like-minded humans.
Yeah.
I think it'll be a time of more tests. We'll be tested in greater ways. And I would, mm-hmm. I would like to think, because, you know, I'll pass on probably not to just in the future, and, you know, that hopefully some things are in place to show younger people of this, you know, artists and more like-minded folk who want to work with making things with their language and the vision of, you know, how people can live in this world, how you can actually construct a more enlightened, you know, society where there's less hierarchical and patriarchal and so on. So, you know, that there's blueprints are there, the rooms are there to be unlocked, the sort of maps for a consciousness are there. We have to really take care of them. We have to work with our archives. We have to preserve intelligent, you know, thinking, and not become amnesiac in all this. So, you know, it's a huge job, I think, to be awake and aware, and it's full time. And you take your issues and concerns and stay, you know, stay with them. That's kind of what I see. I think it's important for people to grow their own food.
Yes, yes.
It's very practical issues, things like that. I can create more alternative spaces, public spaces, whenever you can, wherever you are, whatever city you're in, try to get a little storefront, or, you know, rent a church hall, or, you know, continue to have some social engagement. I mean, the net is great, of course, for all the communication that you get all over the world, and it's a powerful, I think, can be a powerful cultural and intellectual tool and activist tool, but it, you know, you also need to have keep the kind of one-on-one sort of, you know, people gathering together. I think it's important doing it all, both. You know, creating libraries and texts that you want to share and disseminate among others, and sort of wake, you know, awaken you in all the art forms. I mean, I just saw the new Herzog movie, Cave of Forgotten Trees, which is, you know, wonderful meditation on this cave art from probably 32,000 years ago. Its relation, you know, liminal relations to animals and other thought forms and magic and practice, that, you know, trap consciousness that can move around. So these, you know, they're seeing the world as a book, seeing the world, seeing all the, you know, that every encounter is a should be honored and to be precious, and also if it's a challenge, it could be, you know, you can wake up no matter how desperate or violent. So it's hard. You have to be strong to exist in the model of the chaos. Oh, big job.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep reading. Keep reading all kinds of things. Keep your faculties fresh. Try to work with other languages and other cultures. I'm not sure what I see, but Kali Yuga is really coming upon us. You know, it's very heated up, where there's this exaggerated sort of intensity, emotional intensity, where you know, just cutting through even our very personal static is quite a task. And then we are in a world where, you know, this species, Homo sapiens, many people say, maybe not the man who knows, the wise man, the most apt, but, you know, this is the first species that's actually killing its future generations, killing its children with toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been meditating on that. Why are we killing our children?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, Kali Yuga, and in that particular manifesto or feminifesto, Kali Yuga's all over the place. Everything Kali Yuga, everything through that lens, I guess. But it also energizes you. So the more heartbroken you are, the more you feel compassion. I guess that's the idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also shared. It's a shared experience. But I think building, again, all this community work is so important. It's very hard to take on, everything alone. Although I, retreat is it too. You put yourself outside the fray. You become more synchronized in your actions and your thinking and your mind.
That was most of Anne Waldman's conversation with Robin. And I'll include the link to the full audio interview on the Reality Sandwich story for this podcast. I'm going to close this first of what is hopefully many Sporecasts with a song from Anne's album, The Milk of Universal Kindness. Here she performs her husband Reed Bai's poem, pardon my pronunciation here, Avalokiteshvara. Thanks for listening to this first Evolver Sporecast, and here's Anne Waldman.
The milk of universal kindness from a breast beautifully formed of the sky's own blue funnels down through sunny air. In awe, the love I lust for dies. Nothing to have that isn't here. Nothing here that isn't fed. And I was already drinking this milk of kindness when I numbly locked onto the need. Kindness from a breast beautifully formed of the sky's own blue funnels down through sunny air. In awe, the love I lust for dies. Nothing to have that isn't here. Nothing here that isn't fed. And I was already drinking this milk of kindness when I numbly locked onto the need. Thank you.